We are joined in the studios once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning to you.
How are you both?
that seemed to throw you. Would you prefer we say something, you know, like sarcastic or cutting or whatnot? Yeah, something humorous.
Witty and long-winded.
Sure. Oh, there you go. Okay.
That's what I'm used to.
All right. Well.
Just kidding. So,
my cousin is the former deposed finance minister in Ghana, and I have all this money if you'd like to, you know, like help me hide it for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And give me your bank account number.
Yes.
Your social security
number. I'll need some sort of, you know, like something to prove that I can trust you, some sort of a bond or something. That would be a good idea.
Look, I don't see why you have to bring that up just because I got snookered in twice to that deal.
Third time's the charm.
All right. Speaking of snookered, we've been talking about Iraq for weeks, and we'll get to that. But this week we're going to start out talking about the state legislature.
Yeah, we're going to talk about what's been going on down in Olympia. There have been a lot of bills that have come through. Some passed, some didn't. The two main bills this year that everybody is looking at are the operating budget and the transportation budget. And we're going to take a little time to talk first about the operating budget. There are two houses of the state government, the Senate and the House. The Senate is controlled by the Republicans this year, and the House is controlled by the Democrats. And they're quite a ways apart on what they want to do with the operating budget. Last year, Governor Gary Locke proposed a budget that would make severe cuts in social and health services. And the Senate has adopted a budget that very closely resembles Gary Locke's proposal.
In other words, the Republican-controlled chamber is the one that resembles Locke. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, right? And the House, the Democratic-controlled chamber, has been trying to work out a budget where they restore some of those cuts. So the Democrats have been kind of running ever since, trying to play catch-up, trying to fill some of the gaps that were proposed by their Democratic governor, Gary Locke. The House version passed out of committee. It's been struggling on the floor of the House. The Democrats think now that they have enough votes to pass it, however. It involves a 0.2 penny increase in sales tax, and it includes some sin taxes like on booze and cigarettes. It also puts taxes on candy and soda pop, and it relies on increased gambling revenues, which are not a sure thing, as some critics have pointed out.
They're gambling on the gambling revenues.
Yeah.
Right. And it restores some of the cuts. But at issue, when the two chambers have to sit down and work out the differences between the Senate budget and the House budget, are some of these cuts and whether or not the sales tax is going to survive. A lot of people think that the Democrats will have to give up the sales tax increase because it's very, very unpopular. Excuse me. At issue, I just want to name for people some of the things that are being cut this year and to also complain a little bit because the draft budget that Governor Locke did last year and that the Senate has used as its blueprint for their budget also assumes that the economy is going to pick up next year, and I don't know that that's a sure thing. So we might be facing this again next year in a supplemental budget, looking at all the same things and making even deeper cuts. I just want people to know what's at issue here.
Yeah, and beyond that, also, the assumption that the economy is going to improve also affects the amount of demand for some of these social services that are going to be cut.
Right. Another assumption that was made in drafting the budget, too, is that health costs would increase by only a single digit rather than double digits, which has been in doing in the last, like I believe, 8 to 10 years. Healthcare costs have been increasing in the double digits, and many businesses will tell you that they've seen that with their own healthcare expenses for their employees, that it's been double digits, not been single digits. So we're almost certainly going to see the legislature revisit the budget again next year and make further cuts. But this year, so that people know exactly how deep the cuts are, I'm just going to rattle off some of the stuff. We're going to see raises for low-paid state employees on the line. Teacher raises may be slashed, and that includes raises mandated by initiatives that were passed by voters last year. Also, class size reductions will probably go out the window. We're going to see $60 million cut from programs for low-income and at-risk children. That's children that are going to lose these benefits. We're going to see the elimination of the child health insurance program. That's a very distinct possibility. We may see cuts in between 40 to 60,000 low-income kids from Medicaid, depending on which version of the budget pass. These are children, again, who are going to be affected by this. We're going to see cuts in foster family and adoption services, again, impacting children. We may also see tens of thousands of low-income people, somewhere between 20 to 60,000, depending on who's doing the estimates, of people, low-income people cut from the basic health plan. And I think that some of the assumptions that went into drafting the governor's budget and the Senate budget may be the end of the basic health care plan, particularly the assumption that health care costs are only going to increase by single digits next year.
Yeah, it has the potential of actually bankrupting the plan over the next couple of years.
I really think that it might be the end of the basic health plan. And a $20 million cut from mental health services, as well as eliminating subsistence payments. This, I believe, is actually the worst thing in this budget, eliminating subsistence payments for about 10,000 unemployable, disabled, and or mentally ill people, people who need that money to stay in housing and to feed themselves.
That's unemployable.
Unemployable, people who cannot and probably will never, ever be able to find a job.
And who do not have any other source of income. They're not eligible for Social Security. This is the last rung of the you know, safety net or the ladder or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, if this program is cut, you're literally guaranteeing that the vast majority of those people, the people who don't have families or the people who couldn't support them, are going to be turned out on the street. And those costs are going to be borne by society, too. They're going to be borne by emergency rooms. They're going to be borne by emergency health care services. So we're going to be paying more in the long run anyway.
And you will see a lot of these people on the street, because if they don't get this extra income, it's going to be very, very hard for them to pay even the subsidized rent that they pay now.
We're going to see him on the street. It's kind of Gary Locke's way of bringing us all together.
Yeah, it sort of encourages community because, you know, we'll all be gathering together in one place in the soup line.
Oh, God.
So except for Gary, of course.
Yeah. Right. He won't ever be in the soup line.
No, but he'll still
be. Nor will his donors.
He'll still be ladling it out from somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's stuff with the operating budget. Is there other things that the legislature is?
Well, let's talk about the transportation budget.
Yeah, and I would add parenthetically also for the operating budget that people need to be contacting their elected representatives in Olympia. And for most people in the immediate Seattle area, certainly within the city limits, and also for many of the suburbs, that means Democrats, particularly in the House, who really need to hold the line. And the Democrats who are going to be in the conference committee really need to hold the line against that Senate budget, because it's going to make an enormous difference in a lot of people's lives. So folks can still influence this.
Yeah, what's going to happen now is the two versions of the budget go to a conference committee that tries to reconcile them, work out the differences, and come up with a version that will pass both houses in a quick vote. That's not likely to happen by Sunday, which is the end of the regular session, and it will probably go into overtime with a special session.
Yeah, as it has for the last several years in a row now. In fact, last year it went through three sessions before they could come up with a budget. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like it'll go that long this time, but then people have said that in previous years too.
All right, so transportation budget sounds like, you know, we probably really don't need much of one because we're all going to be out in the streets.
Yeah, well, exactly, and yeah, and we won't be able to afford automobiles either, which will and in fact, it's very interesting. The traffic projections, the projections out, you know, 10 and 20 years as to how bad the traffic will be, particularly in the Puget Sound region, which is where most of the serious traffic bottlenecks are and the transportation bottlenecks are. It's been getting better the last couple of years because there hasn't been as much traffic because of the economy. The transportation issue.
What do you know?
Yeah, how about that? The transportation issue is the other big issue this year. And of course, what happened is that when Referendum 51 went down last year, the statewide transportation plan, there was a big controversy last year in Olympia as to whether to pass something or defer it to voters. The decision to defer it to voters won. The voters threw it back. And so the legislature has been wrestling with it again this year, and they've been trying to do so bearing in mind what the voters told them. Unfortunately, different voters told them very different things. There were two major reasons why people voted against Referendum 51 last year, and it pretty much went along both party lines and geographic lines. There was the objection to the 9 cent per gallon gas tax, and there was also a widespread environmental movement, you know, strange bedfellows, the anti-tax folks and the environmentalists, who objected to the fact that statewide package was very, very road heavy and included some very environmentally unwise projects in the overall package. So we appear to be very close to having an agreement between the House and Senate on a possible transportation package that would pass and become law this year, as opposed to going back to voters. The specifics of how it would be funded have not been nailed down yet, but it looks like what it will include is a 5 cent per gallon gas tax increase, and then some other sources of revenue that would pay for over the next 10 years also, and that includes a 15% increase in fees for some trucking and a couple of other miscellaneous revenue increases. The big question at this point is what projects will be funded with that money. Now, bear in mind that of the no votes, the no votes that came from Puget Sound, plausibly the environmental concerns were at least as important as the anti-tax concerns, and yet the message that many legislators in Olympia took from the vote last year was primarily the anti-tax message. You have an enormous amount of pressure in Olympia, and the expectation is that this package is not only going to be as road-heavy as last time, it might even be more road-heavy than last time, because you want to mollify that segment of the electorate that will still object to the 5 cent per gallon gas tax increase. So that's the negotiation process that either still has to happen or still has to be revealed to the public. Now, the priciest of the roads projects in the state are all in the Seattle area. They include things like the Alaska Way Viaduct, expansion of 405, a second bridge over the Evergreen Point where 520 is.
Widening I-5.
Widening and resurfacing I-5. And, in fact, the DOT came out with an announcement several weeks ago that not only does I-5 need to be resurfaced, the whole freeway needs to be torn up and replaced over the last 10 years. That's going all the way down to the bedrock, where you have a freeway that was built to last 40 years. It was built 40 years ago, and yet the traffic projections over those 40 years have been far heavier than anybody. You know, there's more traffic now than anybody in 1962 would ever have imagined. And so, you know, you're going to have not only this massive I-5 construction project, but it's also going to put an enormous amount of pressure on other arterials in Seattle, and you can imagine what Seattle would be like if I-5 and the Alaskan Way Viaduct need to be replaced at the same time. So, you know, all of this stuff is going to need to be funded somehow through some combination of federal, state, and local. There's almost no federal money available for this sort of thing right now. There's going to be a regional package that will probably be going before voters later this year that's going to have to tie in with this somehow. And there's still all of the environmental concerns that that attach themselves to all of these projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pretty horrifying. Lots and lots and lots of roads.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, let's face it, we could just get steamrolled by this, right?
I just want to talk really quickly about some of the issues that didn't get addressed in the legislature this year. A prescription drug bill. The state was looking at starting up a bulk purchasing group that would buy drugs and then resell them to low-income seniors and other low-income people for much less than they'd have to buy at a retail pharmacy. A watered-down version passed the Senate, but it stalled in the House and is probably not going to go anywhere.
And let's remember, the House is the Democrat-controlled chamber, so
exactly.
They're the folks who didn't do anything at all on this.
Right. Health insurance coverage for small businesses. It was an effort to provide health insurance to employees of businesses with less than 50 people, but to make it such a bare-bones plan that business would not object to it. It turns out everybody objects to it. They really could not reach a compromise between employees who need health care and want decent benefits and employers who don't want to pay much for a health insurance plan that's dead, but it's going to probably come back in future sessions.
And to be fair, small businesses are also getting run out of business by health care costs. I mean, they literally cannot afford to pay for health care for their
employees
right now.
And so most don't provide it. Yeah, that's true. There was no state income tax proposal that went anywhere this year.
Or any other kind of tax reform.
No bills that would eliminate any of the state's 431 tax breaks, most of them for businesses, that total somewhere around $46 billion and could have brought revenue into the coffers. And also, I want to talk a little bit about what bills did pass that are good bills this year. The legislature did pass a bill making it a misdemeanor to sell or rent violent video games to minors. Washington residents can now have a mental health advance directive drawn up, which is sort of like a living will. If you think you might at any time become incapacitated from mental illness, you can have an advance directive drawn up that defines your treatment plans so that you can specify now that you do not want electroshock therapy, for example, which is something that people should be considering because some of the mental health treatments that are available can be pretty inhumane and pretty horrible.
Yeah, I was going to say people should be considering electroshock therapy.
No. They should be considering drawing up an advance directive, particularly if they think they might become incapacitated due to a mental illness, maybe that's hereditary in their family, or if they have already had some entanglement with the mental health establishment already because they might have post-traumatic stress disorder or some other illness that's been defined.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who have mental illness problems that are chronic, particularly people who, for example, are medicated but can go off their meds, and it's amazing how quickly you can lose your rights when you're in that system.
Yeah, it is. There was another bill passed that requires police officers to be trained in how to interact with developmentally disabled people and those who've been diagnosed with a mental illness. It would teach cops how to recognize, communicate with, and de-escalate conflicts with these kinds of folks. I think that's really a response to the situation that David Walker was in when he was shot by police officers, a man who kind of flipped out and was having his own mental health problems
shot,
at the
shot
time.
And killed.
Shot
that
and
was,
killed.
Yeah, that was on Queen Anne in, I think, 2000, about 3 years ago.
Yeah, and then there was one other bill passed that was really a Homeland Security type bill. The legislature passed a bill allowing local governments to raise property and sales taxes to fund criminal justice and health services issues. Now, the health services in local communities are what are really being cut this year in the state budget. So this was very necessary for local governments in order to continue a lot of community health services, was to be able to raise revenues by raising local property taxes and sales taxes. However, they have to go to voters for approval on these. So that was one thing that passed the legislature this year that I think was a good bill.
Yeah, and I want to also give props to to one bill that did not pass, even though it was being heavily pushed both by Governor Locke and a number of legislators. And I think it's a tribute to a number of activists that it did not pass, and that was Governor Gary Locke's push once again to lift the limits on surveillance powers and intelligence gathering powers for state and local police departments. A number of the other sort of homeland security measures that Locke wanted passed, it was not as intrusive a bill as the one that he proposed in 2002, but it was still pretty bad. And the ACLU and a number of civil liberties activists really helped stop that one dead in its tracks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving from our state to the next largest state, the United States, and its actions in Iraq. Several
the newest state.
Our newest, the 51st state of Iraq.
God.
If they have their way. So things seem to be falling apart there more than coming together.
There are a lot of schisms emerging in Iraq. First of all, there's the schism between folks in Iraq who want a secular state versus those who want an Islamic state. And obviously the U.S. supports the former, but not the latter. But as it turns out, a lot of the folks who support a secular state in Iraq are former Ba'ath Party members, folks who worked under Saddam Hussein, those who are at least among those who are qualified to serve in a new administration, and they are not being accepted gracefully by the rest of the Iraqi population for obvious reasons. Now, among the folks who are pushing for an Islamic state are some Sunni Muslims. That's the group that largely backed Saddam Hussein are the Sunnis. But there are many who also would like to see an Islamic state come about. Most of the Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq, and they make up the majority of the population, have been following Shiite clerics who have been calling for an Islamic state. And I just want to describe the three groups that are among the Shiites that are actually now starting to fight each other for control. One of those groups is headed by a man named Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They're very fundamentalist, and the State Department believes that they have some ties to Iran. They're not the largest group among the Shiite Muslims, however, although they do control Karbala and the city of Kut and some other towns along the border between Iraq and Iran. The largest group could be said to be the group that's headed by Sayyid Ali al-Sistani, who's a 70-year-old Muslim cleric in the holy city of Najaf. He's a pacifist. He also believes in an inclusive government that would include Kurds and Sunnis and Turkmen and other ethnic minorities, but he would also like to see an Islamic State. And there is a third group headed by a guy named Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, who is the son of a martyr, a man who was a prominent Shiite cleric who was killed by the Saddam regime and whose name is often invoked by people who talk about the crimes of the Saddam regime. He is only 22 years old, and his followers are not pacifists. In fact, they were the guys who folks think were responsible for the killing of the two Muslim clerics in Najaf about a week and a half ago, including the man that the U.S. had put their hopes, and the U.S. and Britain had both put their hopes on, to be the Shiite, the new Shiite leader of the Shiites in southern Iraq. That man is now dead because of al-Sadr's
a friend of Jack Straw and Tony Blair, in fact, and very close ties to the West.
Yeah, so there are problems because these groups are fighting each other now. There's also been groups fighting in northern Iraq. The Kurds are fighting. The two main Kurdish parties have gone back to their old battled ways of fighting each other. There have also been reports of Kurds pushing Arabs, in other words, Sunni and Shiite Muslims, out of their homes in Kirkuk and Mosul. There have also been reports of some members of the Turkmen minority being murdered by Kurds. So there's already been ethnic infighting. And I just want to mention, because this is not being mentioned in the mainstream media anywhere, that at the end of the first Gulf War, the George Bush Sr. regime here in the United States decided not to invade Iraq, and they decided primarily because they knew that this would be a problem, that there might be ethnic tensions, infighting, and that the Shiites would want an Islamic State. And so George Bush Sr. and his advisors decided it was not a good thing to topple the Iraqi government and open up this powder keg. However, George Bush Jr. is not listening to those voices now and has decided that that's not a problem, even though these things, which are emerging now as a problem, and they could have been foreseen and should have been foreseen.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you have the Bush administration parachuting in 23 different exiles in the last 48 hours in order to take over the various ministries in Iraq. All of whose buildings were mysteriously burned to the ground in the last week and a half. And all of these different factional groups that are starting to fight each other, really to the point where I think in the next week we could see civil war start to develop, as well as an insurgency, because they're all agreed that they don't want the United States naming particularly people with no legitimacy inside Iraq, but they don't want the Americans calling the shots at all. And to give an idea of the arrogance that the United States is exuding, which is really pretty offensive to all of these different factions. You have the Bush administration, when you have literally hundreds of thousands of Shiites marching on the holy city last Tuesday, which is the first time they'd had an opportunity to make that pilgrimage.
Close to a million, I believe.
I saw those reports. you have not only the reports that the United States is surprised by the strength of the Shiites, but you've been getting these statements ever since then that it's just Iran who's behind it all, and if we can only get Iran to stop nudging these people or calling these people to arms, we'll have no problems. In fact, you even had Jay Garner, our Israel loving viceroy, who's the man in charge of handing Iraq over to a puppet regime, coming out with a statement a couple of days ago saying we're not going to accept any out of region influences. Well, aside from the fact that Iran has the longest border with Iraq of any country, you know, it's Britain and the United States that cannot conceivably be considered anything other than out of region. But you know, if I were the Shiite majority, and bear in mind that if you add all of these factions together, the Shiites make up 2/3 of the populations of Iraq, and they have suffered tremendously under 35 years of a dictatorship. And the Ba'athists were originally supported by non-Iraqi factions and Western factions, including the United States and the CIA. They are going to make it's really kind of an insult to assume that those folks are not going to do everything possible to make sure that they at this point have the ability to control who's going to run Iraq. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't want that and have made preparations for that. And they're not being even getting given credit for that basic desire for self-determination by
right.
the Americans.
And I just want to mention the last split here that is of importance, and that's within the Bush administration itself. The Pentagon, Rumsfeld has expressed this directly, does not want any Islamic parties in the government. They would be happy to just push all of these Shiite groups out and not consider them at all. On the other hand, you have the State Department, headed by Colin Powell, saying, and the CIA saying, look, you got to incorporate some of these parties into the government or it's going to lead to civil war. Now, which of these two groups is going to win the heart and mind of George Bush? I think it's pretty clear that George Bush understands violence, but he doesn't understand diplomacy. So I think he's going to probably follow Donald Rumsfeld's dictates. And I think that's going to be very bad in the future for the Iraqi people.
Yeah, and we're seeing exactly that same split for North Korea right now, too, which we don't have time to talk about.
But. All right, minute or less, the U.S. apparently is going back to the U.N.
Yeah, this next week they're going to put a draft resolution in front of the U.N. to ditch 10 to 12 years of U.N. resolutions and completely do away with the oil for food program. The U.N.'s going to resist this because it's going to mean that the U.S. will then have total control over Iraq, both politically and economically, because then the U.S. will be able to sell oil and do whatever they would like with the proceeds. Now, the U.S. has said that they want to put the IMF and the World Bank in control of a fund that the oil revenues will go into. That shows you exactly where the U.S. is headed. It's away from an inclusive political government of the U.N., of situations in the world that involve conflicts, etc., and towards a body like the IMF and the World Bank that is largely controlled by the U.S.
And failed just about everywhere it's been involved in.
Yeah.
Okay, quickly, events that are coming up this week.
Yeah, and I also want to put a plug in for a story that was in Thursday's Guardian, guardian.co.uk, about minors being held by the Yates at Guantanamo Bay in Camp Delta.
Yeah, kids that are under age 16
yes.
being held at Guantanamo
yes,
Bay.
Yes, including a Canadian national. So very, very frightening stuff. A couple of events that are of interest this week. On Wednesday evening, activists from Canada, the Native Americans in the U.S., and Mexico talking about the effects of NAFTA and the prospective effects of FTAA. That is at 7 o'clock at Kane Hall on the UW campus. And Tuesday night, Citizens for Commercial Free Schools are holding an orientation, although it's not necessarily specific to that issue, for people interested in running for the school board. If folks are interested in that, they can call CCCS at 523-4922.
Very good. All right. Talking this week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants, even the public library around
fish
town.
Tanks.
You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org. And you can, if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer, you can call our voicemail at 903, that's 206-903-9461.
All right, well, we still actually have a minute left. Tell us, I've been wanting to do this for a long time, some of the specific places people can find Eat the State that you distribute through.
On Capitol Hill, we're in the Broadway Market in a couple of places. There's a little free place outside of Fred Meyer. There's also a little free publication place near the Juice Bar there in the Broadway Market, one of the places you can find us.
And that's and Jobs just drawn a
he's just drawn a blank.
Yeah, no, there's a number of different neighborhoods where it's present on
Joe Barr on Capitol Hill is one of the places you can find it.
The Bellevue Library System carried it for a while.
King County Library System carries it.
Yeah, all over the east side, the King County Library System carries it. University District, Wallingford, Fremont, a number of neighborhoods. If you have specific requests,
Still Life Cafe used to carry us until they got rid of their free publication.
Yeah, so. So if you have specific requests for your neighborhood, again, you can call the voicemail and ask, and we will get back to you. It's, again, 206-903-9461.